Friends, listen with me to this word from Paul's letter to the Romans. So then, brothers and sisters, we are debtors, not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received a spirit of adoption. When we cry, Abba, Father, it is the very Spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if in fact we suffer with Christ so that we may also be glorified with him. The word of the Lord. £3 apiece. That's all each puppy weighed. We hadn't planned on having two little puppies, but the living conditions I found them in were cruel, and I did what I had to do. I rescued the puppies from that awful situation, and I called John from 6 hours away from home to tell him we now had two puppies. And then I turned my phone off for the rest of the trip to let him get used to the idea. So by the time I got home that night, John couldn't help but see how adorable those two little puppies were. And all was well in the Mount Shoop house until about 4 a.m. in the morning when they started to whimper to go outside to the bathroom. Now, John took them out. After all, he is a good sport. But he didn't realize he needed to stay out there with them. And he came back upstairs, and I said, where are the puppies? Outside, he said. Well, you can't just leave them out there. They're too little. So I rushed downstairs and opened the door just in time to see a huge owl coming straight for the puppies with its talons out. I scooped the puppies up, and I ducked for cover not a second too soon. And the owl floated right by me and took his perch in a tree right by our deck and looked at me and spoke sternly to me about me taking his breakfast. Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo! Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo! Would an owl really eat a puppy? I called the Raptor Center that day just to check. Anything under 5 pounds, they said, is a good meal for an owl. I'd watch your puppies closely until they're about 8 pounds or so. Now, anything that would eat a puppy would be pretty easy for me to feel hostile toward, but coming that close to that owl was a humbling moment. He was just doing what owls do. And for him, it was about survival, maybe survival of his mate or his owlets, for all I knew. Even though he tried to eat my new little puppies, I felt a reverence for the owl. He was a powerful being. Owls are intricately built to be what owls were created to be, efficient and accurate hunters of rodents and other prey, mostly at night. Now, the anatomy of the owl is nothing short of awe-inspiring. Their eyes are huge, but they're not eyeballs like ours. They're tubes that cannot move in their sockets. They function like binoculars and allow them to see in dim light or even in total darkness. Some owls can hear a mouse squeak from half a mile away, or even hear animals that are burrowing underground. Their ears are asymmetrical, and sound is directed by that disc-like position of their feathers on their face. Owls can know the precise location of their prey by the barely detectable time difference it takes sound to get from one ear to the other. Owls can move their necks 270 degrees. They can tilt their heads back 180 degrees. They have feathers that are put together with different textures and variations that make their flight perfectly silent. Owls are made to thrive in the dark. Owls can be who they were made to be and know how to work in the dark. Now, what would the world be like if we humans could be who God made us to be and know how to work in the dark? The Apostle Paul was not afraid of the dark. Paul's own journey taught him to go into his shadows to tell the truth about how much he needed God. It was Paul's time in total darkness, struck blind on the road to Emmaus, that transformed him from someone who was filled with hate and hostility toward the followers of Jesus to a person who was willing to risk his life to share the gospel. Now, I was taught in seminary to be wary of Paul. If y'all haven't already figured it out, all of my professors were feminists, so they did not like Paul. And his dualistic language was to be encountered with suspicion. Now, it's true. Paul's dualistic language of body versus spirit has done a lot of damage. It has been appropriated in the Christian tradition to teach human beings to hate our physical bodies, and that is not a good thing. But I believe that God calls us to engage the parts of Scripture that we wish were not there. Exploring the Word with the Spirit's help and exploring our own reactions and assumptions about the Word, well, that's the only way we can really cultivate a healthy relationship with God's mystery. So with the Spirit's help, I read Paul's words here today, not just as a product of a culture in which dualism helped them make sense of things, but I also read this passage as an invitation to all Christ followers across time and culture. Paul was writing to people living at the center of political, economic, and military power, and he was telling them they could be who God made them to be in the midst of a self-destructive, idolatrous, and dangerous world. Paul was inviting the church in Rome to stay engaged in a complicated world, at the same time that he was encouraging them that they did have what they needed to stay clear on who they are, adopted children of God. Because of their adoption, Jesus' followers are freed to be free of the bondage of sin, to engage the world faithfully, not to escape the world or reject the world, but to have the eyes to see the world clearly, even in the dark, and to serve God in the world faithfully, even in the dark. Paul is proclaiming that our created nature, our relationship to our bodies, and our relationship to the world are now equipped to work in the dark, to live proper to our nature in a world that can make it hard to see the truth, a world that can make it hard to hear the truth and hard to trust our surroundings. Now, this past Tuesday, we started our session meeting with Trinity Trivia Night. I know you're sorry you missed that, but you can ask any elder about all the fun Trinitarian facts that we learned together. The first question on Trinity Trivia Night was, name the book of the Bible where the word Trinity shows up. Does anybody know the answer? Joe, yeah, that's cheating, Joe. You were at the session meeting. It's nowhere in the Bible. The Trinity, that word does not show up in the Bible. Theophilus of Antioch was the first to use this Greek term, the triad of the Godhead, in about 180 AD. Now, the Council of Nicaea was called by Emperor Constantine in the 4th century to try and create a broad coalition of Christians by coming to some agreement about the Trinity. Questions about the nature of the Trinity, how three persons of God were related to each other, how one God can be three, how this threeness of God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit worked. Well, these questions had become serious points of conflict among teachers of Christianity. And there was really not a clear church hierarchy at that time that could create any precedent around a concept of orthodoxy that carried any teeth yet either. Now, while Constantine, the emperor, wanted to find agreement and build a broad coalition to strengthen his reign, Bishop Athanasius, who was referred to by many as the gangster, was not about building a coalition. He was about besting his rival, Arius, and increasing his political traction. Athanasius won out, and Arius was banished. Now, Arius was a beloved teacher in that time, and he was known for having women leaders in his circles of learning. So when Arius was banished, also the practice of having women teachers became heretical, unorthodox in the church hierarchy. Now, while the Trinitarian formula that emerged from these politicized and less than laudable conditions has a lot of theological richness to it, I have to wonder, and maybe you do too, how different the church would be today if at that turning point in our development, those with power had decided to be inclusive of different theological perspectives instead of generating this practice of labeling beliefs as orthodox or heretical. Now, the last question at Trinity Trivia Night was not trivial at all. It was, what is important to you about the Trinity? Now, none of the answers we shared that night had anything to do with doctrine. They had everything to do with relationship. Our relationship with this mysterious God. The Trinity is about divinity and darkness. The holy mystery of a powerful love that's willing itself into every crack and crevice, every shadow and seed of human existence. Now, we tend to hear the word darkness as synonymous with bad. We have a bias that has taught us to think of light as good and darkness as bad. But everything needs darkness to grow. Seeds, cells. You and me, we gestated in the darkness of a womb. And mystery needs darkness to grow. Trinity is really about connection, vitality, relationship. It's not about dogma or orthodoxy or political one-upsmanship. It should never have come down to lines being drawn and faithful believers who weren't afraid to wonder being banished. God, the three in one, is about the mystery of God with us and beyond us. Sacred brushes with God's intimacy and immensity. The Trinity draws us in close to holy mystery, and it ignites a profound humility and wonder. Now, another one of our ancient church fathers was named Pseudo-Dionysius. Great name, isn't it? He is the father of what's called negative theology. Now, negative theology sounds bad, deficient. It sounds negative. But negative or apophatic theology is mystical theology. And it asserts that we can only begin to abide in God's mysterious nature through the practice of cognitive negation. So Pseudo-Dionysius understood himself as an interpreter of Christianity in the 5th century, so not that far removed from the impulses of Nicaea. But through the interpretations of Pseudo-Dionysius, he did much more than perhaps he imagined he was doing. He gave birth to a new way of encountering God's mystery. God's mystery in his time was fast becoming a sword in the hands of this adolescent hierarchy of the church. The ecclesial hierarchy was showing itself to be more about flexing its muscle by defining and enforcing orthodoxy than about supporting and encouraging all those who loved and sought after God. But this ancient one, Pseudo-Dionysius, in the midst of all that political wrangling, tasted the mystical harmonies of divine love. And the theology that he wrote was poetry, a poem of negation and elation, of letting go and coming closer. Just listen to his poem about the Trinity. O Trinity, beyond essence and beyond divinity and beyond goodness, guide of Christians in divine wisdom, direct us towards mysticism's heights. Beyond unknowing, beyond light, beyond limit. There where the unmixed and unfettered and unchangeable mysteries of theology in the dazzling dark of the welcoming silence lie hidden. In the intensity of their darkness, all brilliance outshining, our intellects blinded, released from all, aloft to the flashing forth, beyond all being, of the divine dark. Now, not long after that, Al scolded me for stopping him from having breakfast in my backyard. My extended family went on a trip in the mountains of Tennessee. One of the activities we could join in during that weekend was a walk at night to listen for the call of owls. My dad and I decided to go. It was a dark night. You could hardly see anything. There was hardly any moon at all, and I could barely see my dad just a few inches from me. The guide took us along the wooded perimeter of an open field and told us to wait and to be patient and to listen. After a while, we heard it. Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. The guide told us that was a barred owl. And I learned something about the owl that must be living near my backyard back in Charlotte. I would never forget the sound of that message he got to me when I stopped him from getting my puppies for breakfast. Now, after some silence, we began to hear a call and response between two other owls. Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. The guide told us those were great horned owls. Maybe a male and a female. Maybe two males coordinating their efforts so they didn't interfere with each other's hunt. These animals were so tuned into their surroundings, and I was well into my 20s and just learning the sound of their voices. How little I really know about this planet, I say, is my home. It was a moment of wonder. It was a moment of humility, a moment of connection with the mysteries of this life. You see, mysteries need darkness to grow. You and me, all the people of faith, we're called into the life-giving dark of mystery, into the bewildering dark of a world seemingly hell-bent on its own destruction, into the ambiguous dark of our own shadows and the unknowns that face us every day. and into the shimmering dark of a God we will never fully know or understand. A God who holds us in the dark and will never let us go. The Trinity is a deep breath. The Trinity is letting go of our thoughts. It is about having the courage to spend some time in the dark, trusting the something more, trusting the impossible to grasp, believing there is a source of love so powerful, so wise, so alive with love that you and me can actually learn to be who we were made to be in this world. God's children who know how to work in the dark. Thanks be to God.